Grade 1 Conference, Lecture 4, The Fourfold Human Being, Part 4. A lot of fours in that. We must be coming to the end of this subject. Although, as I said earlier, it's really hardly the beginning, because this fourfold human being will be the theme upon which we play so many variations in our classrooms. A few words more about the astral body. I don't mean to typecast it as the villain in this great melodrama of the primary grades, though, again, it must be approached with caution and with due respect for its very great power over the children and over us as well. Where we have sympathy and antipathy, where we have love of beauty for itself, where we bring color into our subjects, where we speak very low and speak very loud, all of these things are working with the astral body. It's not that we never want it to be there, but it's important that it always be there in the service of the developing child, and that we recognize today, perhaps it's Monday, we need a little bit more astrality to help awaken the children, to get them moving. The astral body is responsible for our capacity to move in every way, physically as well as in thought and in feeling. Perhaps on Friday we need a less astrality in the class, and there we'll bring in some more purely etheric forces, and we'll see how to do that. Now, I will certainly point this out when we're speaking of any number of subjects or of artistic activities. I do want to just speak a word of caution that, and for some reason this applies more to teachers of my own gender, of male teachers rather than women, there's more on the part of men of feeling that one needs to entertain the children, that you know, we're competing with television, and we're competing with the internet, and we're competing with three-dimensional films, and you name it. It's all competition out there. Children's attention spans are shorter, they're overly stimulated, so let's keep working with all of that and show them we can do that too. And one has to be very careful about that, because that's where, when you go from aesthetics to entertainment, when you go from movement to mere stimulation, then the astral body is decidedly encroaching on the territory of the etheric body. And the result will be, as the astral body is like this, it just makes you hungry for more and more and more, because the astral body is the body of variety as well. The etheric body is the body of consistency, just more of the same. The astral likes everything to be different all the time. And one has to be very cautious about this, because in the short run, yes, it can excite a class, it can make a class rapt with fascination and attention on their teacher, it can make the teacher something of a star in the classroom. But that should not be confused with what is needed in grade one, which is really that the star is not the astral body of the teacher. What really lives as the true star is the ego of the teacher. And the ego is not about coming out and shining all over the place brightly, but rather it has more to do with the harmonization, particularly harmonizing the forces of the etheric body and the astral body, bringing true balance. I'm sure that many of you from your training or in other contexts are familiar with Rudolf Steiner's wonderful sculpture, The Representative of Humanity, or The Representative of Man, as he called it, in which you see this central figure who can be called the Christ being or can be called the ideal human being. And it's not a matter of pulling anything down and kind of, you know, standing at the center of everything, but rather creating a center by balancing the contrary forces, one of tremendous expansiveness into the spiritual world with no limit, which we could say is connected to an overabundance of astral forces, and the other is to hardening into mere form and mere structure, and not being able to really move with that. So we could say this sort of etheric gets caught in the physical, and this is what Steiner speaks of as the Ahrimanic forces, the overly expanded forces, luciferic. We don't have to go into that right now, but I would just say that here again, that's a wonderful image for all of us as teachers to feel not so much that we are creating something, but rather that we are allowing the space to be filled with forces that are contrary in and of themselves, cannot find balance in and of themselves, but need the teacher to bring about that space, to open up that realm of possibility where these two contrary forces can really meet and fructify one another, and something really new and something truly creative can arise out of the child in feeling these two sides of her being being met and brought into balance. So that's where the ego is. With a few exceptions, we are going to see very, very little in the way of ego forces in grade one among the children. And this then tells us right away, we need to be that ego. So we don't have 20 or 30 little egos running about in the classroom. We certainly have 20 or 30 little etheric bodies and often astral bodies as well. But the ego that really matters most in the class, the one that makes the weather, this is the teacher. And out of this comes what Rudolf Steiner speaks of as the central force for learning, the central sort of educational pillar in the grade school, in grades 1 through 7, 1 through 8, which is authority. That the children are now moving from imitation to authority. And they are learning now not just by watching what the teacher does, but also by listening. And think of that. You know, one wants to understand the dynamic of the eye and the ear. How in the kindergarten years, so much of a child's forces of will, their limbs, are activated by what they see. They see the teacher sweeping, a child wants to help and sweep. See the teacher kneading dough, two children ask if they can help and knead the dough, or cutting vegetables, or whatever. A lot of it is not dictated, mandated by the teacher, but rather he or she allows the children out of their imitative forces to begin to learn things, some of it memory, some of it, more of it, really, connected with the life of habit. So the eye becomes the window, literally the lens through which the teacher's will activities in particular can be made manifest in the child. as we go into the grade school, and it does not happen all at once, but by fourth grade, the forces of imitation have become subsidiary. They are still there and always will be there. They still are always the first step in learning pretty much anything. But now they become subsidiary to those forces that manifest as the child listens to the teacher. So now the spoken word on the part of the teacher is to some degree the equivalent of the movement of the limbs in the kindergarten by the kindergarten teacher. And for the child, the ear is to some degree the substitute for the eye through which they saw the world in kindergarten. Now it's the ear hearing the world, reflecting upon what is heard, making what is heard his or her own, that becomes the great force for education and change. And with this, the teacher has to, in a way, assert his or her authority. Parents should as well, and sometimes we'll realize a big part of our work as Waldorf teachers isn't only what we're doing with the children, but helping the parents feel confident in being authorities to their own children. Because imitation can only in the end take us as far as habit, which is, relatively speaking, brought into the world of sleep. You know, when something is a habit, we don't have to think about it anymore. It almost has a life of its own, like, you know, putting your foot on the accelerator, or when you have to stop, getting your foot onto the brake immediately. You're not even thinking there. It's far deeper than that. But in the grade school, we want the child to be awake. We want the child to be thinking about their actions and understanding that there are possibilities of action. And for this, we need to bring in the intermediary of authority. And the teacher has to have the confidence and the ego forces necessary to stand before a group of children and be able to say, you know, this is what this is. This is how you do this. This is what happened. Everyone, please stand up. Everyone, please sit down. And one of the great forces opposing this assertion of the teacher's ego, the teacher's authority, is the asking of questions. Now, I won't say don't ask any questions, but using a tone of voice in which, without realizing it, without thinking about it ourselves, we are again and again asking the children, could you all stand up? Do you all want to go out now for recess? What would you like to eat for lunch? Of course, parents do this a lot more than we do, but that the teacher clearly thinks things out, especially actions, but also artistic activities and a whole range of other things in the classroom. It's thought out first. It's not arbitrary. You have a rationale for whatever you're doing, and this helps to move the class forward. And this is where the children get an image of what they themselves will begin to carry in another 14 years or so. You're really giving them a picture of their own future as you stand before them in this upright, ego-like way. Once again, I'll be speaking about this in other ways when we particularly look at how to introduce some of the artistic activities to children in the classroom, where once again, one might be tempted to give a whole range of choices, but how important it is in first grade that choice is something very special, only meted out in the smallest, most homeopathic amounts, so that in the upper grades, particularly grades 7 and 8, more choices can be given, and you can be confident that most of the children in the class will probably make the right choice. But that doesn't happen automatically. And this is an area where you will sometimes, perhaps in some classes often, in some classes all the time, you will encounter misunderstanding and even opposition from parents who feel that you're being authoritarian, not just an authority, that you're being too restrictive, you're being, ultimate insult, too Germanic. And we have to understand this and really keep working with it, because those cliches can have seeds of truth in them, and we want to be sure that our authority is coming from the right place, from the ego, which is part of our adult fourfold being, but which is not yet there. The child is still 2.5-fold or 3-fold, perhaps, but the ego is something that comes from on high, ideally from the teacher. We will go on now to look at another aspect of this fourfolding of the human being, the very well-known four temperaments.